Welcome to episode 10 of the Haskell Cast. I'm Brain Henricks with my co-host, Chris Forno. Our guest today is Brian O'Sullivan. You probably know Brian because he's written about half of the Haskell code you use, or because he manages the Facebook team that uses Haskell.
I don't.
You don't.
But we can talk about that.
Okay, let's start there then. What do you do at Facebook?
So my job at Facebook is to work on developer efficiency, for want of a better description. And so that takes two different aspects, right? On the one hand, we build tools to try and make life easier and smoother for our engineers. And on the other hand, we build defensive tooling to try and make it safer for our engineers to make mistakes. So on the doing things efficiently side, that involves everything from source control through to compilers, through to continuous integration infrastructure. And on the making it safe to make mistakes, things like static analysis tools, test infrastructure, and other good stuff like that.
I see. And what is your relationship to the team that Simon Marlowe is on?
None. Yep. So what the backstory there is I've known Simon for a long time. And when I got inkling of the possibility that he might be lured out of Microsoft Research, I did my bit to see him safely into Facebook. And I did actually work closely with him for, I don't know, maybe the first year or so that he was at the company. Mm-hmm. But then he had a sufficient degree of success without really needing any input from me that we were able to go our separate ways. So we still talk on a fairly regular basis, but we have no direct working relationship these
so
days.
Do you use mostly Haskell for your day job, or is it a part of
me?
Your day job? Yeah.
I would say I use mostly my mouth for my day job.
Fair enough.
And I might get to spend a few minutes a week coding if I'm lucky, but no more is code really part of my actual responsibility.
Sure. So then you work on a team. Does that team use Haskell? Does it? I know that Simon's team uses Haskell. I'm trying to figure out what penetration Haskell's had into the engineering culture at Facebook.
So we probably have, we've got a, you know, decent sized handful on the order of a couple of dozen people using Haskell as their day jobs. And I do have a team that does some work in Haskell. I also have some engineers doing some work in OCaml. We're a fairly big tent sort of company, right? So we have people using all kinds of other functional languages too, from Erlang through to Clojure through to a little bit of anything that you care to name. And that makes for a pretty interesting environment to work in.
Were you a part of the process of selling Haskell to Facebook? How was Haskell sold? How was Facebook convinced that they should work with that technology?
There isn't really a process for selling a programming language to Facebook. Usually the way that sort of thing happens is quite organic. So as a case in point, you know, some engineers come along and decide, hey, we're going to build thing X in language Y. And, you know, provided they're not coming up with something completely lunatic, like, hey, we're going to build a massively scalable system in Ruby, then they can just kind of go do that. And, you know, we'll deal with the necessary tooling adjustments and so on as necessary. So we're not very centralized in that respect. People have a fair degree of flexibility in choosing the right tool for the job.
So there's no overarching sort of attempt to control or unify or rationalize, is the term I've heard before, programming language choices at Facebook?
I'd say it's very, very minimal, right? So, you know, obviously we don't want every engineer to be using a language of their choosing, right? Because then you end up with this Tower of Babel effect. But we do give people a good degree of flexibility in making the right choices for their circumstances. Now, of course, you know, oftentimes what people find in practice is that language choice can be secondary to availability of libraries when it comes to actually being productive. And therefore, you know, Facebook having 10 years of investment in a relatively tight core of different languages such as C++, Hack, Python, and one or two others, it's going to be much easier to get your work done in a language where you can just pick up some library and start using it, rather than to go, oh, well, you know, this is going to be great after I get my first year's worth of preparatory stuff out of the way. Then I can actually be productive.
So let's get into just a little bit of the specifics of this at Facebook. I know that Hack, for instance, the Hack language looks like it's written in OCaml. But then there's also Sigma, which relates to Haxel somehow. Could you speak a little bit more about Sigma?
Yeah. So Sigma is our spam fighting service, and it uses Haxel as essentially a core. Right? Haxel is a core library that provides an abstraction for asynchronously and efficiently fetching and batching fetches and caching results of data fetches from all of our various internal services. And it's written in quite a general way, right? So it's not actually tied to Facebook infrastructure, which is what a part of why we've been able to open source it so early in its history. So think of Haxel as kind of the underlying abstraction that powers how Sigma is implemented these days.
Okay. How has your personal experience with Haskell affected how you direct and lead the team? I know you're spending most of your time managing, but I'm sure you field questions from some of the engineers and you have some input in the design.
I actually try not to have any input in the design, right? So that's not what I see as kind of the value that I try to bring to these different teams. But let's pull it back to the Haskell side. I think it's actually relatively hard to tie any Haskell experience to the kind of work that I do these days, right? So, you know, for the most part, I'm responsible for dealing with, this big, diverse population of engineers and trying to come up with tools and approaches that are going to work for them. And I suppose the most obvious way in which there's a connection between the two is just in how open-minded a lot of people in the Haskell community taught me to be relatively early in my career, where people were just curious and, you know, willing to explore new things, willing to try interesting, not necessarily conventional ideas. So I think that personal influence, far more than any kind of love of abstraction or anything like that, really stuck with me more and more as my kind of career evolved from banging out code to managing managing these larger organizations.
You mentioned that you only get maybe a few minutes, if you're lucky, a week to work with code. But I have noticed that you still do manage to sometimes make some really interesting changes to your personal projects, specifically regarding performance and dealing with some edge cases that you've run into. And just to name a few that people may not realize, you're behind. You have ASIN, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yep.
AttoParsec, Text, Criterion. These are kind of, I think of them as foundational libraries for a lot of professional Haskell work that's going on from what I've seen. I imagine you don't get much time to do this anymore. How mm-hmm. difficult is it to jump back in and make a change if you haven't looked at the code for, I don't know, months or a year?
It's pretty straightforward. You know, it might take me a little while to kind of spin back up to speed, but one of the big ways in which these libraries that I built, I tried to make them maintainable was by, you know, writing them in the most straightforward manner that I could that still actually delivered the performance that I thought I needed. And that means that the code is actually relatively accessible for the most part to, you know, either an outsider or me putting on my outsider hat after not having looked at any of it for ages.
I was going to say, I sometimes think that if I write the most clever code I can, there's a good chance I won't be able to understand it later.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of some clever code, there's an interesting balance that you seem to strike between cleverness and performance. And with performance, this Criterion, this benchmarking, micro benchmarking library, I saw something interesting about it that I haven't seen before, and that was that you provide a linear regression model. Was that an idea that came to you, or you'd seen it before in other tools, or you're just used to using that kind of statistical tool?
You know, that idea came from a similar benchmarking library that some folks at, I think, Jane Street wrote for OCaml applications. So it's been kind of an interesting process of people lifting the best ideas from each other, right? So the original basis that Criterion was written on, I think, came from the core of a Java benchmarking tool. And the Java benchmarking tool had a much more complicated environment to deal with, right? Because, of course, the Java JIT has this habit of changing the behavior of your code over the course of time. So Haskell is more straightforward to deal with on that front. And the folks who built this OCaml benchmarking library at Jane Street basically implemented the same ideas as Criterion did and found that they weren't terribly happy with how stable the results were, right? There was a fair amount of variance in numbers that they would see on repeated runs. And so they had this clever idea of going, well, what if we just, you know, change the number of iterations and then do a linear regression over the variation in iterations and see if we got something that's a little bit more stable. And what they found was that they got a much better and smaller, tighter variance in run-to-run performance numbers out of that. And also that they were able to measure much cheaper operations as a result of not depending on being able to measure these tiny time intervals. So that was kind of a nice quality of result coup that they pulled off. And of course, you know, they very sensibly talked up the advantages of this approach, and I was paying attention, so I said, well, I'm just going to go ahead and steal that. And so I did.
Very nice. And just to follow on that really quickly, you mentioned that it's actually more straightforward with the environment that Haskell brings, but it there is the trickiness of laziness. And in the documentation, there's mention of putting things into weak head normal form and so on.
Right.
This is something a lot of Haskellers, even myself, sometimes get confused about. So what kind of quick tip or could you distill it into what people need to do for benchmarking something that may be lazy?
So I think the principal thing to do is figure out what it is that you actually want to measure, right? If you want to measure the cost of generating a fully evaluated data structure, then you should be using normal form, which is available in Criterion via a function called NF. And if that's not what you want, then weak head normal form is probably the thing that you're looking for. And really, which of those you should be choosing depends on what you think your application needs to be looking at, right? So for example, for something like a tree data structure or a text value or something along those lines, then weak head normal form may be sufficient. For something like a potentially infinite data structure, then weak head normal form may be necessary because you don't want to actually try and evaluate the entire thing because you'll never actually get a result back. So it does take a little bit of sophistication to figure out exactly what it is that you are looking to measure, right? Because it's very easy to gull yourself into thinking, hey, I'm just going to evaluate this result to weak head normal form, and then realize after the fact, hey, my seemingly expensive operation only took 25 nanoseconds because it turns out that all I was actually doing was just evaluating it down to the first constructor of a list, that the rest of which remains completely unevaluated. So that's the most typical approach for somebody to make a mistake. But it's usually relatively obvious that your numbers are just way out of whack compared to your expectations if you do make that kind of mistake.
I actually wanted to follow up on the performance thing because I think you possibly have more experience writing high-performance Haskell code than, let's say, 90% of the population of Haskell developers. I've noticed that in some of your blog posts, for instance, you have a post about optimizing the unencode function in AutoParsec. And what you ended up doing was you pre-allocated a buffer.
Yep.
And that's interesting to me because pre-allocating a buffer solved a laziness problem. But mm-hmm. that's something that I would have reached for in C or other low-level languages immediately. Mm-hmm. So what part of Haskell optimizations are do you employ typical methodologies that you might find in other languages? And how much of it is unique to Haskell's non-strictness and laziness?
It's a mix, right? And it depends on the particular abstractions that you're working with, for want of a better description, right? So in the case of AutoParsec, we're typically dealing with inputs that are big flat buffers of stuff, and that makes it relatively straightforward for the underlying store for your bits to be a big flat buffer full of stuff. And then the trick becomes one of going, okay, how do I hide the fact that I have a mutable big flat buffer full of stuff in my implementation so that nobody can peek into it and see something change in front of their eyes that they ought not to be able to see. On the other hand, we have, say, something like AutoParsec, which is at the higher level, quite heavily continuation-driven, right? And in that world, you end up having to think about things like, when are bits of information passed from one continuation to another in, say, a boxed versus an unboxed form? Or when is a continuation that I'm about to call going to be inlined or not? How much is my code going to explode if I try and force things to be inlined? And those are typically considerations that, say, a C or C++ programmer is less likely to have, just because they are less intimately dependent on the performance of inlining of lots of tiny little functions for things to either perform well or explode horribly.
How much special knowledge of, for instance, GHC idiosyncrasies like unboxed polymorphism, mm-hmm. how much special knowledge of the GHC compiler have you acquired? How much of that have you found necessary when reaching for really tight performance?
I've acquired a fair bit of it over the course of time, and I've forgotten almost all of it. And I think the forgetting happens more quickly than the acquiring. So at any given point in time, I'd say I don't have a particularly extensive toolbox of GHC internals. And the result of that is that sometimes I end up in a situation where I could probably get more performance out of the code if I was only willing to, break open the GHC internals and read it for a bit. But, life is short, and I'm not always willing to commit that kind of time.
How important do you think it is to know those things when you're going for performance? Do you think you can get everything you need, or do you think there are some cases where you really have to go look into GHC?
I think it's one of those you can get 80% of the benefits with 20% of the knowledge situations. And I try and make sure that at most of the time I have only 20% of the knowledge, because I'm happy usually with 80% of the benefits. So, provided you understand some really obvious basic things like strict versus non-strict and boxing versus not boxing of small atomic values like integers, you're kind of You're on the road there, right? That's not the 80%, but it's the first steps in that right direction, and picking up the rest of it really doesn't take all that much effort.
So I wanted to maybe take a step back. Usually at the beginning of these things, we ask people about how they got into Haskell, and we sort of started mm-hmm. in the middle. So I wanted to go back and ask you, before most people had even heard of Haskell, you're writing the text library. How did that come to be?
Okay. So you want the origin story of the text library or the origin story of me doing Haskell stuff?
The second
actually,
one first.
They actually have, believe it or not, the same genesis. So let's see. I'll start with the proper origin story, which is back in the early 90s when I was in college. I was a terrible undergraduate student, right? In Ireland and in much of Western Europe, the undergraduate educational system is very different to what it's like in the US. So over there, most of the time, you've got this fixed curriculum of stuff that you have to sit through. And you're going to take classes whether you care about them or not. And I am not very good at following other people's instructions about what I ought to care about. So I cut class like crazy, when I was an undergraduate. And I spent a bunch of time learning about Unix, you know, going, reading books in the library and stuff like that instead of going to class. And in retrospect, it was exactly the right thing to do, right? I have rarely regretted, no, sorry, never regretted that decision. But a part of the process involved, I stuck my neck out when I was in, I don't know, third year or something along those lines, and applied for an internship in a supercomputing center in Switzerland. And I brought one book with me, which was a book called Implementing Functional Languages by Simon Peyton-Jones and I think Simon Lester. And couldn't make head nor tail of the bloody thing, right? I had pretty much grabbed it off a shelf, and it was my sole reading for an entire summer stuck in the mountains in the middle of nowhere. So I sort of bulldogged my way through it and sent Simon a note about 3 or 4 months later saying, hey, could you please take me on as a summer intern? And it's a very Simon-like thing to say that he didn't ask me for a resume. He just said, okay, when can you start? So that's how I ended up working for, you know, Simon as an undergraduate student for a summer. And it was a pretty intense and great experience. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. But as part of that, I built a type called Packed String. And Packed String was a, you know, an array of contiguous bytes, is this starting to sound familiar, that could be stored compactly and operated on relatively efficiently. And it sat around in the GHC internals getting various amounts of use for several years until, this was maybe even longer than several years, maybe over a decade, until Don Stewart and Duncan Coutts came along and built the ByteString library, which was kind of a successor to this Packed String. And ByteString then bopped along for a while until... I'm going to forget his name. Tom something. Tom, I really apologize for forgetting your second name, since you wrote the genesis of what was going to turn into the text library. So he built the first iteration of the text library as part of his master's thesis at Oxford. And then I basically picked it up and turned it from a master's thesis into something that you could actually use. And so he deserves credit for kind of, you know, getting the ball rolling, so to speak. But probably 90-some% of the code that's in the library now is mine. And I built the text library, you know, just basically observing that we were 20 almost years into Haskell existing, and we still didn't have a really performant way of handling Unicode. And gosh, wouldn't it be nice if we did? And so text kind of married the best of the ByteString implementation with Stream Fusion as a way to try to get better performance out of pipelines of code. And it seems to have worked out relatively well. But of course, you know, I wasn't content with just making sure that the text library was functional, right? I actually wanted the damn thing to be fast. And so I looked around at the various different benchmarking libraries that were available for Haskell at the time and decided that they were all not up to snuff. And so as a next thing, in order to benchmark the text library and benchmark the ByteString library, I decided I would write this thing called Criterion, which also spawned a library called Statistics, which is a big, you know, library full of code for dealing with samples and statistical distributions and so on. So I must have written an extra 25 to 30,000 lines of code in order to benchmark the text library and demonstrate to myself that it was fast enough. And of course, along the way, I discovered a whole bunch of ways in which it wasn't. So it led to a further pile of implementation. So really, what the text library is and what Criterion is are reactions to this code that I built when I was about 20 years old as an undergraduate student in a lab in Glasgow.
So now in 2015, after you've been doing Haskell for a bit longer, what excites you about Haskell development now? What interests you these days?
I think the stuff that I find interesting at the moment is just kind of the breadth of things that people are doing with Haskell. And, you know, that varies from, you know, Edward Kemet's mad science, like let's apply category theory to everything approach, through to really interesting libraries like Pipes and Conduit, you know, down to people building applications with Haskell these days, right? Be they startups or individuals putting together some tooling. So it's kind of nice to see that the tent is still big and that people are still finding their way in and being able to actually kind of make a difference to the fate of the field. That's pretty cool.
You mentioned Ed's mad science. How much of that mad science do you employ in your own work? Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of category theory, abstract nonsense going on into your, at least what we can see about the way that you reason about these tools that you're writing.
Yeah, I don't tend to use that particular mental toolbox very much. And that's mostly just because I prefer to think and operate at a somewhat lower level of abstraction. You know, my main interest is not in building sort of fancy abstract code. It's in building really fast stuff that I can actually use to solve problems. And you can certainly apply some equational reasoning and little bits here and there of categorical special sauce to that end, but it's actually not all that helpful in general. And so, you know, I prefer to operate with the toolbox that I have rather than crack open another one and be not entirely pleased with what's in there.
Hopefully this will motivate some people who think that they can't do Haskell because they haven't read category theory textbooks yet, that they actually know they can, and you can get a lot done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, let's move on to talk. I want to return again to the performance side of things. And I remember when Real World Haskell, the book, came out and how exciting it was to see, okay, we're going to see how guys who are not just, you know, solving toy problems use this language. A lot has changed since then, as you yourself have noted. Where do people go once they finish Real World Haskell now? What are some places they can look for new information or where to go next?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually don't really know the answer, to be honest. I think we could certainly do with a new generation of learning material that is not, you know, scattered across a zillion Stack Overflow answers and a trillion wiki pages and a bunch of random Reddit comments. And it would be pretty good to see somebody actually step up with that, right? I can see there being kind of two different things that would be valuable. One is a cookbook, right? Take, say, the top 20 Haskell libraries that people use and write a chapter per library. Here's how you get started with this thing. Here's what you can use it for. Here's how to understand how well your code is performing when you're using it.
Maybe they can contribute that to the documentation.
Yeah. Well, contribute it to the documentation, or better yet, actually, like, stitch it together into a single book and call that, like, you know, further adventures in Real World Haskell or what have you. And of course, you know, the original book itself is obviously sorely in need of a revision too. And, you know, that's, I think, a little bit beyond my energy levels these days, since I have other distractions to keep me busy, but it would be a useful thing to have. So, you know, in a way, we're better off than we were, say, a decade ago, before this current generation of books came along. But now that the books have aged a little bit, it would be quite beneficial to have another turn of that publication-related crank.
For anyone interested in doing that, could you give them an idea of what the process of writing Real World Haskell was like? I mean, I imagine it was a big project. How long did it take? How intense was it?
It was probably 18 months of continuous effort, of basically sitting down and writing as much as I could within a window of an hour or two. 4 to 6 days a week. So, you know, not a great amount per day. And really, it's one of those things where any individual day's effort felt kind of insignificant, but it slowly amounted to something over the course of time. And that's really what the process of producing something pretty good is like. And, you know, if you go through the website, you'll see that there's plenty of comments on mistakes and oversights and things like that, because at some point you kind of run out of steam, right? You've read each chapter more times than is reasonable. You're actually blind to the mistakes that you've made, and you just can't handle another round of comments, right? So it's finally time to just say, you know what? This has gotten to the best place that we could get it, and let it fly free into the world. So it is certainly possible to produce a better book than we managed. But I'm still, even in the light of, you know, almost 10 years of it being out there in the world, pretty happy with how it turned out. But it's a friggin' soul-sucking process producing one of these things.
I think you have a right to be. Not everybody can send out checks for every revision, every mistake, and keep revising their book through their entire lifetime.
No kidding. Well, you know, it's one thing if you're a Don Knuth and your job is to, like, you know, sit in an ivory tower and produce pretty things permanently. Because, you know, he can legitimately say, I'm not going to talk to anybody this month or this year. And I'm just going to, crank out a new portion of a chapter of TAOCP. But, you know, the rest of us are in that web of obligation between family, friends, jobs, life, etc., etc. And there you kind of, you know, you have to make that 80-20 rule apply, right? Where, yeah, sure, I could put in five times as much effort and get a book that was 20% better, and, you know, maybe I wouldn't have to worry about a family anymore because they'd all have gone. And I chose to optimize for a slightly different outcome than that.
So just following up on that a little bit, on this idea of a few things that people can get the biggest bang for, are there mm-hmm. a few things that you have in mind that you if you had the time and you could magically throw them in as an addendum mm-hmm. or a few extra chapters on real world Haskell, what would they be?
I think for a sort of a modern real world Haskell, there is definitely some changes of emphasis that I would put in, right? So I'd probably have a chapter on either conduit or pipes, which are fairly widely used libraries for essentially asynchronous programming, right? They don't make it look like asynchronous programming, but that's essentially what they are. They're sort of reactive programming done slightly differently than the ways it's done in more mainstream languages. So those are pretty significant. I think I would put some time into building both the client and server sides of web APIs, because that is a thing these days. And, you know, there's a few good frameworks and libraries available for doing both of those things. Certainly more than there were 8 years ago. I think I would probably also revamp something like, say, the performance-oriented chapters, right? Because Criterion didn't exist back when we wrote real-world Haskell, and it's a relatively straightforward thing to use these days. I would probably also be talking about some of the operational considerations around making a Haskell-based service run well on something like AWS, right? So, you know, how do you monitor this? How do you determine whether you have a memory leak? How do you actually resolve those kinds of things? That all turns out to be pretty important in practice and very much real-world concerns. And I would also add some material around, well, what if you're talking to some other kind of system, right? So be it a database or a distributed system, right? So talking to MySQL, using Thrift to glue components together that are written in different languages, whatever it happens to be, right? These are other interesting aspects of making Haskell actually work in a real environment that would be well worth covering. And they go beyond just the how do I even program in Haskell in the first place, which is book one of that series.
Well, if anyone's interested in writing a successor to Real World Haskell, perhaps you can tell them where to send your portion of their royalty checks.
There you go.
Okay, so let's go away from the real world for a second, back into academia. I see that you mm-hmm. Just last year taught CS240H again at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any change in the kind of students that are coming through that particular class nowadays compared to in the past? I know it's probably just been a few years in that class, but I imagine you have
experience. Yeah, I've only been teaching it for a few years, exactly. So I don't think they all just look really young, right? And they keep getting younger. But that might be me. But no, I don't think there's been a significant shift. I mean, Stanford students are a distinct and unique bunch compared to the typical student population. And they tend to be pretty bright and motivated, and that makes for an enjoyable environment to teach in. But I can't say that I notice any, like, population shifts, but my sample size is small and infrequent.
You also mentioned that that you actually enjoy being in the room with so many engaged minds as opposed to like a MOOC experience.
Yeah.
So do you think you will continue with it, or do you or will you be I mean, do you want to continue teaching Haskell and functional systems?
Yeah, I'm actually signed up for CS240H again this year, and I'm looking forward to teaching it again. And, you know, I think some of the things that'll be fun about doing it this time around are we spent altogether too much time helping students who were stuck in Cabal hell, familiar terms, I'm sure, right? So we'll probably get them to use FP-Complete's stack tool this time around, and hopefully that will let them focus more on writing code and less on why the hell doesn't my bloody code even build in the first place. So that should help free up people's time to focus on what actually matters.
Have there been other more Haskell-related sticking points in the curriculum? What do you find that people struggle with the most?
They struggle on all the classical things, right? So by the time they come along to CS240H, they've already been taught how to program in imperative style. They've already been taught object-oriented programming. And now they're basically being given this different mental tool set. And the things that they have to unlearn in order to be able to take advantage of it are like all the same things that the rest of us struggled with. So there's nothing new under the sun there, right? So everything from like how do I think about laziness to, you know, how do I pass around a piece of information from function to function to function that, you know, you as a more experienced Haskeller might think, well, I'll just toss that into a state monad or whatever it happens to be. Coming up to speed with monads at all is as usual kind of a problem. And then, you know, moving on to other areas that are a little bit more off the beaten track, like, say, applicative functors or things like that, end up being little bumps on their own path, too. But, you know, one of the things that comes from teaching the class again and again is figuring out a better mental model of where students are likely to stumble and also what path through the forest actually leads them into the light the fastest. So I think we've gotten better at it over the few years that we've been teaching it, and I'm hoping that we'll manage a better iteration again this time, right? So I'm often throwing away previous year's notes and kind of redoing them, partly as a service to myself so that they're fresh in my mind, and also partly because my thoughts around how I can do a better job evolve from one year to the next.
That's especially interesting because there are some internet communities that are using your lecture notes from previous years as a basis for a sort of informal MOOC or learning curriculum.
Right.
And I have to think that that must be much less efficient than being in the same room and having access to a lecturer and being able to talk about things.
I don't know. It varies. I mean, one disadvantage of the traditional lecturing model is that you think that maybe people are going to actually stop and ask you questions and so on, but they actually don't, right? It's very much a performance in front of an audience rather than some sort of an interactive thing. And it's actually quite difficult to break away from that model, right? Because as inefficient as the I am talking at you, you big pile of people is as a model for teaching, it's actually much easier to do than actually forcing everybody to like sit down, talk to each other, talk to you, challenge you with questions, and be able to roll with the punches, right? So actually taking really strong advantage of the fact that everybody is stuck in this room for this assigned period of time, it's hard, and I will not make any bones about that. I'm not sure that that model would actually translate well to being recorded for a MOOC forum, but I think actually that, you know, looking at our lecture notes is not nearly as much of a step down from being in the room as you might think, except for, like, you know, my stupid jokes are not normally present in the lecture notes.
People seem to be doing pretty well with them, and I was surprised because I sort of assumed that something important would have been lost without being there.
Yeah, no, I tried to write this the lecture notes in a style that makes them relatively straightforward to follow, right? So there's kind of there's a few different schools of how you put together slides to give talks, right? Mm-hmm. There's the I'm just going to put two or three words on a slide and then I'm going to talk all around it. Or there's the I'm going to fill the slide with so much detail that nobody can actually hear the words I'm saying because they're trying to read all the words. And I try and fit somewhere in the middle. And of course, you know, that's not a balance that I always get right. But I think it seems to work relatively well for these slides being something that you can actually follow after the fact without having to have my voice in your ear.
Do you see Haskell sort of breaking out from its traditional niches of parsers and concurrency and high performance areas and becoming more of a general tool, or do you think it will kind of remain where it's been successful?
It's been growing slowly over the past number of years, but the growth rate hasn't accelerated. So it's hard for me to say that I think it's going to grow significantly more. And I think that's actually fine. I think it's going to continue to have a loyal and devoted following. And I think it's, you know, still in spite of many years of osmosis based transmission of ideas into other languages, a considerably better language for working in than many of its competitors. But, you know, the fact of it is, it's actually got this, you know, difficult to learn reputation, much of which is earned. And, you know, the fact that some vocal members of the community are enthralled to abstract mathematics rather than just getting stuff done is not exactly helpful on that front. So I think there's, if it was going to really take off in some massive way, chances are that would already have happened. But I think that the fact that it's not taken off beyond where it has is not a sign of defeat or lack of success. I'm pretty happy with the world that we have.
It's interesting that people are getting this impression that you have to learn all the math first so that you can understand Haskell. And I think practically for a lot of people, it happened the other way. I learned mm-hmm. Haskell, when I discovered category theory, it was mostly, oh, everything makes so much more sense now that I have this framework to put things in.
Yeah.
But if I had been forced to stop learning Haskell and then go spend 3 months reading a category theory book, I think I would have given up.
Yep. I do not regret my lack of abstract mathematical sophistication, right? It has helped me back.
So following on that, you mentioned that a lot of ideas are getting taken up by other tools and languages. Have you seen anything that excites you outside of the Haskell world? Anything that people are playing with there at Facebook or that you've seen otherwise that you're interested in and if you had the time?
So, you know, not to blow the Facebook trumpet too loudly, but some of the work that's happening both, you know, sort of within Facebook's walls, but is also quite visible to the outside world is quite exciting to me, right? So if you were to look at, for example, the React framework that our engineers have built for programming in JavaScript, and then at its logical extension, React Native, for doing native iOS and Android programming, like the underlying ideas behind React are entirely functional programming based, right? From heavy dependence on immutable data structures through to, you know, these obviously comprehensible and composable pipelines of code for transforming things, through to, you know, construction of the UIs being a relatively stateless process. That is all actually really exciting to me from taking the core ideas that matter about FP and making them available to and exciting to working programmers in a way that helps them to be more productive. So that's pretty tremendous. And, you know, along those same lines, we have this type system that has been developed within Facebook for JavaScript, which also is implemented in OCaml behind the scenes. But again, it takes some of the really interesting ideas from type theory and from gradual typing and applies them to helping people to write practical JavaScript code that is less likely to crash and do surprising things at runtime. And that union of functional programming and strong types in the service of getting people to be more productive in you know, this universally used language that so many programmers are familiar with, JavaScript, is really quite exciting.
What's the name of that one? Is it publicly released? I'm not, it's not.
Yeah, that type system is called Flow.
Okay.
And it has been publicly released.
I'd like just to point out that you didn't say that we need monads in JavaScript. I think there are some things that are sort of trappings of functional programming that aren't really central to the idea. And people get
That's
caught
true.
Up on them.
Yeah. I think if you scratch the surface in React-based programs or in Relay, which is a Relay is a library, again, built at Facebook that is conceptually very similar to Haxel in that it allows you to batch together data fetches and to issue them asynchronously and to cache stuff across requests where that makes sense. You'll see that there's both a common philosophical approach between it and Haxel, even though they're different languages, but also the Relay programming model happens to, you know, sneak in some monads through the back door that you just don't really have to think about very much.
Just as long as we don't have to talk about them.
Exactly. That's right. We just refer to them. What was Simon Peyton-Jones's term? Something along the lines of warm, fuzzy things. So every language needs its warm, fuzzy things.
Is there anything you'd like to talk about that you're working on personally? I see WREC or however you pronounce it.
REC.
REC, okay.
Yep. So, I haven't actually worked on REC in a little while, but, you know, REC was a kind of a two-pronged library for me, right? One was doing client-side web programming in Haskell was just this not very good experience, right? Because there's an obvious need for there to be a pretty high-level API that is relatively simple to use and lets you express reasonably complicated needs succinctly. And that library did not exist, right? So I said, okay, well, it's time to write one. And that's where REC got born. And then the other side of that was it was pretty clear to me that for dealing with the consequences of issuing a web request and actually getting a response back, Ed Kmet's lenses were going to be a really good way of dealing with the semi-structured data that you get back. So I wanted to sort of experiment, for want of a better description, with lenses as an API for making all of this relatively straightforward to use. And I think it worked out pretty well. So, you know, I was aiming simultaneously at having this be a useful library after the manner of Python's requests library, and also making it really powerful to work with. So I think on some fronts, it beats requests, which is this beautiful Python library that deservedly gets a lot of attention and a lot of love. But I think REC for dealing with what comes out of a response is pretty damn sweet.
Especially combined with ASON for handling JSON APIs. I found that if you just write a URL generator and some ASON classes, then you basically get a free client for your JSON API.
Yep, pretty much.
Anything else, Brian? I think we've got 5 more minutes here with Brian before we get a lot of
Yeah, no, I think that pretty much reaches it at the moment. You know, I think actually one interesting thing to talk about is that in a way, my Haskell code has become a victim of its success, by which I mean that I've written quite a lot of code that is open source and available for wide use, and that means that when I can find little bits of time these days to sit down and write code, I'm actually not really writing code for the most part, right? What I'm doing is I'm fishing through several months worth of accumulated GitHub issues, and I'm fishing through several months worth of accumulated pull requests and trying to make sense of them and trying to decide, okay, you know, which one of these things needs some work, which one of these can I apply, where do I need to issue a release, how long has it been since I last released such and such a thing, right? So that's... It's both a good and a bad thing, right? On the one hand, it means that like these things continue to be alive and useful to people, and people are interested in contributing to them. But on the other hand, it means that like I'm sort of like a fly trapped in amber, right? I can foresee there being a fairly straightforward future in which I just kind of maintain the same pile of stuff indefinitely because I have no time. I can choose to either let it bit rot a little and write something new, or sort of do my duty by people. And I have mixed feelings about having co-maintainers in some instances, right? Because it's very hard to find people who are, for want of a better description, ideologically compatible, right? What you don't want to do as somebody who's devoted years to a library is hand it off to somebody who's going to like take it off at like 90 degrees to what you thought you wanted it to be, right? Be that either aesthetically or where the API is or quality-wise or whatever it happens to whichever axis is important to you. So I've clung on to some of these things for probably longer than makes sense. There's a few of these libraries where I've got co-maintainers who are very helpful, but then they become victims of their own success too. So
maybe you need a team of interns.
Oh God, wouldn't that be nice?
Well, usually I don't have anything else. Usually we end up by asking you if there's anything that you'd like to talk about, but we're definitely running short on your time here.
Yeah. No, I think just that interesting observation about like you have to be careful about not writing too much code is not intuitive, right? Because it's not a problem that people necessarily think of, but it's a genuine thing.
Ed, if you're listening, take a warning here, and we'll also have to get you back on to respond.
None of his libraries have any bugs, so I don't think he has. Because they're all based on unassailable, you know, mad science principles.
That's right.
Right. You've been listening to the HaskellCast, Episode 10, with special guest Brian O'Sullivan, recorded on September 23rd, 2015. For notes from this show and recordings of other shows, visit www.haskellcast.com.